They were very different. Esau, the man of action, the kind of guy who kicks sand in your face, taut, hard-muscled, a keen eye, a hunter, a he-man. Jacob, the runt of the litter, having just clung to life and no more. Intellectual, clever, a thinker, a planner, a schemer, one who watched and waited. Jacob, summed up by the prophet Isaiah as, in the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his manhood he strove with God. The emotional dynamite in the situation was the harsh reality that Isaac, their father, was not content to let each be himself, express his own character, and make his unique and valued contribution. Isaac had his favourite, and his favourite was Esau. Esau, strong and virile. He was a real man, doing macho things. And of course, as the elder brother, in him resided the destiny of the dynasty, the destiny of God's people, the God of Abram, Isaac, and Esau. Yes, that had a certain ring to it, a pleasing sound. Jacob, on the other hand, weedy, dark-eyed little Jacob, well, he was a worry, he was a problem, spending too much time with the women, with his mother. A real disappointment, to be honest. Why could he not be more like Esau, a man's man, out hunting the deer from which Isaac's favourite venison hot pot could be made? Well, Jacob was no fool. He knew how his father felt. He knew he was not okay, while Esau, big, hearty, hairy Esau, was most certainly okay. And Jacob came to his mother for the support his fragile ego needed. What a recipe for drama in all this cross-current of hurt, disappointment and ambition. The weak-willed, indulgent father, the brash, confident son, the younger brother, hurt and angry, the mother running her fingers soothingly through his dark curls. There, there, my darling, it'll be all right. One day you'll come out on top. You'll see, Jacob, my darling, you'll see. The differences between the boys and the whole tapestry of the unfolding drama is cleverly summed up in the names of the two lads. Esau, the covered one, the hairy one, the red one, or he who drinks the red lentil broth. Jacob, the name means he who overreaches, the one who gets above himself, the tenacious one who will not let go until he gets what he wants. Jacob, his character full of wiles, compromises and deceits. Yet who somehow sees more clearly than Esau the true value of things. Like the birthright which he purchased from Esau for the now legendary mess of pottage, a phrase that's gone down in literature as a powerful description of someone giving up something precious for something short-term and cheap, to sell your birthright for a mess of pottage, a proverbial warning against swapping something important and cherished for something shallow and unworthy, to give up something valuable for a momentary gratification. So what was it all about, this famous birthright that led Jacob to his deceits and wheeler-dealing? Well, in purely cash terms, Esau really miscalculated badly, because the possessor of the birthright was eligible for a double share of the father's estate. So this was probably the most expensive bowl of soup in all of history, for Isaac was a rich man. But for Jacob, it was the fact that the possessor of the birthright became head of the household. That was the real key, the real motivation behind all his Machiavellian scheming. For to the legitimate possessor of the birthright fell the heritage of the nation. It would be the God of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. And it would be his name, not that of Esau, that would march into history. Suck on those lemons, big brother. The historical identity of the people of God would forever be indissolubly linked with the dark-eyed little Jacob, and who would kick sand in his face then? The promise of God that had come to Abraham and had been confirmed in Isaac would come to him, heir to the promise of God's special favour. Now that was surely worth something. So why did Esau do it? Throw it all away? So that he came to weep bitterly over the whole affair. Regrets, he had a few. Had his reasoning faculties been so undermined by his hard day in the broiling sun? Or was he, as the writer to the Hebrews suggests, a profane man who despised his birthright? For he, as the Genesis chronicler makes clear, is the one who must carry the can. It's not Jacob who is rebuked for his greed and opportunism, but Esau for his abrogation of responsibility, his shoddy, appetite-driven choice, his neglect of the holy things. In Esau's declaration, "What use is it to me?" we see summed up what is increasingly the attitude of Western culture and civilization. We don't say, "What a beautiful waterfall," and enjoy it for what it is. We say, "Now this could be used to generate electricity." We don't say, "What a lovely, secluded and unspoilt sea loch." We say, "We could turn this into a harbour for shipping in the oil-related industries, or we could repair our nuclear submarines here in the deep waters of the loch." Things and people tend to be catalogued according to their usefulness or not. And disturbingly, their usefulness in the short-term immediate sense. So that people come to assess their own worth in terms of their usefulness. The old lady who looks eagerly for death because "I'm no use to anyone anymore" is echoing the mistake of Esau, and our cultural preoccupations aggravate the error. Because Esau missed something crucial and precious. He failed to appreciate that there is out there a whole realm of values that can't simply be added up and calculated and a usefulness label attached to them. What use is a rose? What use is listening to a beautiful piece of music or enjoying a lovely painting? What use is a sunset or a love song or a hug or a hand clasp? When we begin to allow ourselves to think in the reductionist categories of pure pragmatism or mere usefulness, we tumble headlong into Esau's error, his big mistake. The old lady is not useful in any gnarly economic sense, but she is who she is. She is herself, and her value lies not in her contribution towards the financial or industrial or economic strength of the nation, but because she is herself, and there has never been, nor will there ever be in all time, anyone else who is that unique individual. When we begin to stroll around the world with our pocket calculator in our hand, we're doomed because we're blinded from a true and proper Christian evaluation of individuals, of what really counts. "Listen, a nice bowl of soup in the hand is worth any amount of pie in the sky to a hungry man," says Esau. And let's slip his birthright. Notional birthrights in the future are too vague, too far in the distance. Give me something in my hand here and now, something I can touch and drink down in my moment of physical appetite and longing. Now that's what I call reality, Jacob. The here and now, the moment. You can have all the birthrights you want, all the abstract futures you care to consider. This red lentil broth is real. I know what I want, what I really, really want. I want it. And I want it now. And Jacob leans against the wall, arms folded, and watches this big hairy ape slurping down the stuff. And he can barely suppress a whoop of triumph, for he has pulled off a real scoop. Someday soon, Esau will rue his mistake, will appreciate with a bitter regret that he's been short-sighted, that he's looked only superficially on things. He's made the fatal assumption that because from time to time it looks that way, that man does live by bread alone, when in fact there's much more to it than that, much more to us than that, much more. Jacob prefers to invest in the unseen values, the seemingly useless things of sentiment, meaning, spiritual values. With all the coolness of a superb cracksman, he pulls off this audacious burglary of the spiritual jewels of a generation. He knows that the value systems of the marketplace hold no sway in the kingdom of God, that neither a person nor a set of values is to be assessed by their apparent usefulness or not. He knows instinctively that in spite of appearances, man does not live by bread alone and never will, but by those truths and values that are intangible, invisible, and eternal, that are rooted in the very core of our being, represent the very heartbeat of the cosmos, truths that it's sometimes tragically easy to forget, truths that we can sometimes fail to acknowledge are crucial to our wholeness, our humanity. What's the use of worshipping God? What's the use of visiting the very ill relative who doesn't seem to know us anyway? What's the use of praying? What's the use of making sacrifices for other people? What's the use of love? The wise person doesn't look on the surface, merely at the category of usefulness. They look rather to the heart of the matter. And they ask, what does it mean? What does it mean? And when we put that question to our existence, we go a long way towards a proper respect for it. And we begin to find the possibility of understanding who we are and what it means.